From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of Hollywood's first openly gay star. William Haynes was a leading man in silent films. He didn't hide his homosexuality from the press or the studio chiefs. We'll talk with his biographer, William Mann, about the lives of gay and lesbian movie stars of the 20s and 30s. Also, photos of tenements, fires, mob hits, and murders. We talk about the photographer known as Ouija, one of the most eccentric and celebrated news photographers of the century. His pictures of New York in the 30s and 40s were published in the tabloids and national magazines. We'll hear from Miles Barth, who curated an exhibit of Ouija's work and wrote an award-winning companion book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The late winter storm that blanketed the Midwest and Plain states with snow has left frigid temperatures in its wake. Record lows today in Nebraska. In northern Ohio, today's temperatures are about 30 degrees lower than yesterday's. Fruit growers in Georgia and other parts of the South are bracing for the cold air that could threaten their crops. The southern states are also starting to clean up from the severe rainstorms and flooding of last weekend. At least 9 deaths are being blamed on the weather, as NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Rescue crews in Carroll County, Georgia, have resumed their search for a 20-month-old boy who was swept from his mother's car in a rain-swollen creek. Rushing floodwaters are blamed for at least 5 deaths in South Alabama, where nearly 2,000 people spent a second night in shelters. Nearly half the town of Elba evacuated when a levee gave way, sending the Pea River gushing into downtown businesses and homes. Nearly 6 feet deep on Sunday, the river is starting to recede. Still, water levels are halfway up houses and covering cars. Officials say it may be several days before residents can return to clean up their mud and water-soaked homes. President Clinton declared a federal disaster area in 5 Alabama counties. The El Niño-powered storm also caused flooding and tornadoes in Louisiana, Mississippi, and parts of Florida. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Closing arguments are set for later today in the court-martial of the Army's former top enlisted man, Sergeant Major Gene McKinney. The judge told the jurors to consider whether McKinney used his rank to pressure women to have sex with him. McKinney faces 19 charges, ranging from adultery to obstruction of justice. The special U.S. envoy for the former Yugoslavia, Robert Gelbart, arrived today in Pristina, the capital of the troubled Serbian province of Kosovo. The province is in mourning for the dozens of ethnic Albanians killed in a Serbian police crackdown in the last 2 weeks. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports.
Robert Gelbart traveled to Belgrade yesterday to personally inform Serbian strongman Slobodan Milosevic of the further round of economic and diplomatic sanctions his country faces if he does not pull back his special police forces from the province and begin a dialogue with the ethnic Albanian population. The sanctions were decided yesterday in London by the Six Nation Contact Group of Western countries. Gelbart arrived in Pristina today, where he will have talks with ethnic Albanian leaders and university students. Hundreds of people in the region of Drenica were mourning today the victims of the last police onslaught. So far, police have returned 52 bodies to the victims' relatives, including women, children, and elderly persons. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Pristina.
Israeli troops reportedly shot and wounded a number of Palestinians today at a checkpoint near the West Bank city of Hebron. Israeli radio says the Palestinians had tried to run the soldiers down in a truck. On Wall Street, the Dow is up nearly 38 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is trading near record highs today, as Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Technology stocks are leading the advance in a rebound from yesterday's slump. That's after 3 Wall Street brokerage firms made positive remarks on Sun Microsystems. Solomon Smith Barney, Lehman Brothers, and Soundview Financial expressed optimism that Sun will deliver first quarter earnings that will match expectations. There is also strength among drug stocks, as well as diversified health care and money center banking issues. On the negative side, shares in MCI and WorldCom are lower after the Wall Street Journal reported the Justice Department is investigating the proposed merger of these 2 phone companies. I'm Doug Krisner.
China's legislature has approved a plan for eliminating 11 government ministries. That move would cut in half the country's 8 million bureaucratic positions. The reforms are aimed at fighting waste and corruption in an effort to fend off the financial crises that have hit other Asian nations. The European Union is commissioning 4 new studies to determine if there's any risk to humans from hormone-treated beef. The EU's controversial import ban on such beef products will remain in place while the studies are conducted. A World Trade Organization panel has criticized the decade-old ban as running counter to global trading rules. Volkswagen says its net profits last year doubled compared to the previous year. The company earned about $744 million. The report triggered a 6% jump in Volkswagen stock today. A Florida judge who'd been overseeing a class action lawsuit against the tobacco industry has announced that he's dropping out of the case because he's suffering from an illness. The case involves thousands of smokers and the survivors of smokers in Florida. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gay actors are beginning to come out of the closet. It might surprise you to hear that it may have been easier to be openly gay in the Hollywood of the 20s. A new book looks at gay life in early Hollywood by examining the life of silent film star William Haynes. My guest is the author, William Mann. He says Haynes' story is the story of the institutionalization of the Hollywood closet. It's the story of how an industry changed and how in the 30s a community of artists turned its back on its own in the face of organized traditionalist pressure. Mann writes, those who played the game were rewarded with stardom and protection. Cary Grant, Robert Taylor, Barbara Stanwyck, Rock Hudson. Those who refused, people like Billy Haynes, were ushered out. Since few people remember William Haynes' movie roles, I asked biographer William Mann to place Haynes.
He was actually the number one box office star in 1930. You know, that's what, you know, people tend to, if they remember Billy Haynes at all, they tend to think of him as a second-rate actor or a co-star to some of the bigger stars. But he actually was the number one box office star in 1930. And for a few years before that and after that, he was certainly in the top 10.
Now, some of his movies have real macho kind of titles like A Man's Man and Tell It to the Marines.
Right.
Did he play real macho roles?
No, you know, what's interesting is in the 1920s, the leading men in Hollywood were not, they weren't macho. They really weren't about being masculine and aggressive. They were, you know, when you think about the 1920s and the images of masculinity in Hollywood, you think of Rudolph Valentino and you think of Wallace Reed. And, you know, they're slightly less macho, slightly more effeminate. Billy Haynes was part of that tradition. And, you know, there was no intimation that they might have been gay on screen, but they were certainly the leading man. They were certainly the matinee idol. But there was the aggressive, strident masculinity that came to popularize the movies in the 1930s really wasn't in evidence in the 1920s.
Did most people in Hollywood know that Billy Haynes was gay?
Yes, yes.
And did he try to cover it up?
No. You know, what's interesting is that in the 1920s, being gay was just part of an actor's resume. There were a number of stars who were in a sense openly gay. You know, using that term is a bit anachronistic because of, you know, the construct was very different. But they lived lives that were authentic in ways that stars even just a decade later weren't able to live, because the 1920s, the early 1930s was a time in Hollywood where there was a greater openness for those people who lived on the edge. You know, we had people who were political radicals. We had people who heterosexual couples living without marriage, and Hollywood was open for that. It was a real haven for that kind of bohemian lifestyle. So Billy Haynes was certainly openly gay in that sense to the studio chiefs and the studio publicists, but certainly not to the public at large, because there wasn't such an identity yet to be openly gay about.
So when he set up house with his lover, Jimmy, there weren't studio heads or publicity heads. He said, you can't do that?
And that's what makes him so significant. And that's really what makes him a mirror of the times that he lived in, which, you know, his story is interesting in and of itself, but it really takes on relevance when you look at him in context with his times. Because, You know, at the same time, he and Jimmy moved in together. So did Greta Garbo and John Gilbert. And neither couple was married. Neither raised eyebrows in the front offices at MGM. There was an understanding at that time that there was a distinction between a star's private life and his public image.
Well, how did MGM's publicity department deal with the fact that Billy Haynes was gay and he was living with his male lover?
Well, there's been a number of funny stories where they tried early on to pair him up with movie actresses, and you know, Billy Haynes, just unlike a lot of them, you know, he just chose not to play that game. He wouldn't go out on the photo op dates. He didn't appear at premieres with some beautiful young starlet on his arm. He would escort Polly Moran, who was about 30 years older than he was, and Bucktooth. She was one of the popular comedians of the day, and he would turn the studio publicists' attempts to link him with female stars by saying, "Well, I'm going to marry Polly Moran," and the press loved it. The press ate it up. The studios, I think, by 1926, 1927, had really kind of thrown up their hands and said, let this guy be who he is. It seems to be working. Nobody's, you know, questioning him at this point. And they just let him do what he wanted to do.
Were the studios encouraging any of the gay actors to embark on cover marriages?
Oh, sure. But you have to understand that really began to happen later on. When we saw the coming of the production code in 1930, there was a greater sense that the excesses of the Roaring Twenties was really over, and that the public mood was starting to change. We also saw the Depression hit at the same time. By 1934, when the production code was given its teeth and was began to be enforced by the studios in a way of avoiding government regulation, there was a real strict adherence to a certain image and a certain ideal. Stars had to change their images. Even directors had to change their images. The on-screen content was cleaned up, and so was the off-screen lives. People like Clara Bow weren't able to survive. You know, this wasn't just this didn't just affect gay stars. It affected anyone who lived outside of a strictly defined set of rules. And by that point, I think we began to see some stars come in who felt they had to toe the line at the studio, and the studio's attitude towards the stars changed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Mann, author of the new book Wisecracker, a biography of William Haynes, who Mann describes as Hollywood's first openly gay star. One of the biggest threats to Billy Haynes' image while he was a film star was when Eleanor Glynn, who I guess was a Hollywood columnist, wrote
right.
that he didn't have it. You know, there were actors who had it and actors who didn't have it. And mm-hmm. she said that Billy Haynes didn't, and neither did Ronald Coleman, and neither did Raymond Navarro. What did the studio interpret that as meaning, and how did they try to counteract that?
Well, that tapped into all of the studio's fears, because here, after all, was their top box office star who was gay, who was not being linked with actresses in print, who was not being seen around town with the starlet on his arm. And while they, you know, walked along with him for a while, because it worked, it seemed to work, when Glynn did this, they said, okay, everything's going to fall apart now. We've got Eleanor Glynn, who had written the novel It and 3 Weeks and a number of other bestsellers of the time, and was really considered an arbiter of social taste and sexuality in Hollywood. And when she said that Billy Haynes didn't have it, as well as Raymond Navarro, who was also gay, as well as Ronald Coleman, who was slightly more effeminate than she liked, they reacted with the sense that, you know, okay, everybody's going to discover him now. It's all going to come tumbling down. Of course, Billy then went into Louis B. Mayer and said, well, you know, don't worry about it. He said, of course I have it. He says, I have appeal to both sexes, which Mayer, of course, just wasn't able to tolerate.
You say that things started changing for him and for gay actors in Hollywood in the early 30s. One of the reasons why was the production code. What was it about the code that affected the private lives of gay actors?
Well, the code was a list of do's and don'ts that the studios adopted voluntarily to avoid government regulation and government censorship. And ostensibly, the code only affected on-screen content. It was only supposed to be for the regulation of what the movies could show on the screen. However, the code was part of a greater cultural and political shift in Hollywood in the 1930s, indeed in the country in the early 1930s, with the coming of the Depression, with a greater movement of immigrants who were the base of the Catholic Church, which was the base of the reform movement in Hollywood. And so what we began to see was that the off-screen lives of the stars were also coming under scrutiny. We see that a number of stars were forced to change their images, were forced to fit into a specific rule, a specific set of definitions. For the gay stars, this meant that a number of them got married and a number of them ended relationships that they were having because suddenly the whole dynamic shifted. We had the press changed their relationship with the studios. We had the stars change their relationship with the studios. And the public began to recognize this change as well.
Well, how did Billy Haynes react to this new set of guidelines you're expected to follow in your private life?
He, alone among his contemporaries, he refused to play the game. He was, he may have considered it. You know, what's interesting is Anita Page, who I had the great privilege of meeting in Hollywood. She's one of the few silent stars still living. She's a lovely lady, and she told me that in 1932, Billy asked her to marry him. Well, at first I tended to brush it off as some kind of Hollywood myth, but then I began to think about the timing was absolutely right. That Billy would have at that point perhaps considered playing the game because all around him his contemporaries were. They were fitting into the new images that the code was demanding. Cary Grant was getting married. Randolph Scott got married. Raymond Navarro allowed himself to be linked in the press with Myrna Loy. The game was suddenly up for grabs, and Billy Haynes may indeed have considered playing it. Anita Page turned him down, which I think was lucky for both of them. And it allowed Billy to continue to live a life that was more authentic and more honest than any of his contemporaries. And for many, many, many years after him, he lived the most open and most honest life that I could find in the stories of Hollywood movie stars. He went on to live with his partner for 50 years. He did not play the game that the studio was in, that the postcode studios were trying to put upon him.
Do you think he was punished for not playing the game? He was released from the MGM studio in 1934. How much do you think that had to do with his refusal to play the game?
I think it had a lot to do with that. You know, I think what's important is that Billy Haynes wanted to stay with the studio at all costs, and he knew at this point that his screen image was in need of revamping. They were in the midst of trying that with some success. He would have gone into supporting roles. He would have taken character roles. It's far too easy to say that his screen image just simply didn't live up to the times and he didn't change with the times. He would have moved into character parts as some of his contemporaries like Edmund Lowe, who did get married and play the game. Billy Haynes felt that by 1934, he wasn't going to change his life and kick his lover out after living with him for 6 years. He loved this man very much. And so because of that, there was no room for him left. Hollywood had changed so dramatically. There was no place for the kind of lifestyle he lived, because the fan magazines at this point were going to start asking questions that they wouldn't have done even 5 years before.
Do you know what the official reason was for getting rid of him at MGM?
The official reason was simply that his contract had run out and wasn't renewed, mm-hmm. And that he was listed as being at large. Of course, no one's contract was not renewed for just simply letting it lapse. There was always a reason to renew or not to renew a contract. I think what's also indicative is that his agent attempted to get him parts at other studios. And Billy assumed that even if it was a character part, that he would have gotten a part at perhaps Paramount or Columbia or Universal. none of these major studios picked up his option. He ended up at Mascot, which was one of the lowest of the Poverty Row studios. They're the only ones who were able to who would be willing to take him on. That says something right there, that the studios had changed enough that that they weren't interested in picking up this guy who, just a few years before, had been the top box office star in America.
My guest is William Mann, the author of a new biography of William Haynes, who was an early gay film star. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Mann, the author of Wisecracker, The Life and Times of William Haynes, Hollywood's first openly gay star.
After Billy Haynes was let go by MGM, he started a new career, and you say he actually really found his calling.
Right.
Interior design for the stars. He did
right.
Carol Lombard's home and Joan Crawford's home and the homes of other Hollywood stars. It's funny, it almost sounds like a joke. You know, what did the gay actor do when he was kicked out by the studio?
Exactly.
He went into interior decoration.
Right. He may have been the source of that stereotype, right?
That's right. But what impact did he have on Hollywood style as an interior decorator?
Well, it was an enormous impact. He really changed the very look of Hollywood. You know, Hollywood in the early days was, you know, excessive and gaudy. You have to remember, these people were nouveau riche. These were people who came in and bought every trend that came along. You know, Joan Crawford had black velvet dancing girls and you know, dolls with chickens and that laid eggs actually on the table. You know, it was terribly tacky, terribly gaudy, and it was Billy Haynes who brought a sense of sophistication. You know, by the end of the 30s. Almost every major Hollywood star and director had their house done by Billy Haynes, and he moved into Los Angeles society through the 40s and the 50s. The very look of Hollywood itself, he changed how the film colony thought of itself. I think he gave them a sense of style and class that had been missing before that.
It sounds like later on in his life he was on the outs of gay society in Hollywood, that he became a sloppy drunk. He was implicated in a scandal. It was said that his lover had brought a six-year-old boy into the house, and there were accusations about what had gone on there. And that kind of moved Haynes out into the margins of Hollywood gay society.
Yes. In fact, he had started out as being an integral part of the Hollywood gay subculture in the 1930s. He was best friends with George Cukor. He was close with Cole Porter. And there was a real sense of a very vibrant nightlife in the 1930s and 1940s, also, again, contrary to public opinion. By the middle part of the decade of the 1940s, actually after the war, there was a number of falling outs that he had with some of these key figures in the gay subculture. And I think part of it was that, you know, at this point, the idea of being gay in Hollywood had changed radically from it had, you know, just 20 years before in the 1920s. There was a much greater reluctance to act out. There was this new decorum of you know, we have to prove that we are as gentle-mannered as the rest of them. And so Cukor, Porter, these were people who set a great stand on being proper. Billy Haynes never did, and I think the interesting thing is that by 1940, 1945, he had pushed himself away from that crowd as much as they had pushed themselves away from him, that, you know, he just represented a part of their lives that he felt they were a little too flamboyant. He could get drunk. He could get outrageously campy, and that unnerved some of these social arbiters in the gay subculture.
One of the things that surprised you about Billy Haynes was that although he lived what was a pretty openly gay life for his time, some of his best friends were later supporters of McCarthyism. They were anti-gay. And you include in that list Ronald and Nancy Reagan. Now, I know you got an interview with Nancy Reagan for your book. Was she able to address that?
Mrs. Reagan was very clear when I asked her if that was ever a problem for some of her husband's supporters. It was obvious that there might have been a conflict in that at the same time that then-Governor Reagan was firing his gay staffers because of a potential scandal in 1967, that at the very same time she and the governor were having regular dinners at Billy and Jimmy's house. I asked her if there was ever a conflict there, if there was ever any pressure from her husband's supporters, and she said emphatically no, there was never a problem. When I tried to push and find out more about this, she just insisted that there was just never a problem. My sense is that, you know, there probably wasn't a problem. There was again, the social constructs of homosexuality were very different even in the 1960s. This is pre-Stonewall. Billy Haynes had little to identify with these gay liberation supporters. He identified more with the Los Angeles upper crust. And so there was really no sense that he was part of that underworld. Of course, I imagine there must have been some conflicts for him, that he must have had to reconcile this in some ways, and I do talk a little bit about that. Some of his friends have talked to me about the struggles that they went through at that time. But there was people treated each other in Billy's world as individuals, and I think, you know, he felt that that Nancy and Ronald Reagan treated them with respect, and he returned that respect.
We're starting to see some actors in film and on TV who are gay come out. What do you think the climate is like now for people who are out in Hollywood?
I think it's gotten an awful lot better, even in the last 5 years. You know, I think what's so interesting and so ironic about Billy Haynes' story is that actors and directors didn't become progressively more open as being gay since his time, but they became progressively more closeted until very, very recently. I think within the last few years, when we've seen Ellen DeGeneres and Katie Lang and Dan Butler and a number of stars who have come out and shown that they continue to have successful careers, I think that's the real legacy of Billy Haynes' story, that we are getting back into a time when perhaps that will just become part again of what constitutes an actor's life, and that it won't be seen as something so important that's going to color how we treat them for the rest of their career.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Mann is the author of Wisecracker, The Life and Times of William Haynes, Hollywood's first openly gay star. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Naked City. We talk about the now-celebrated photographer known as Ouija, who specialized in taking pictures of fires, murder, and mayhem for the New York tabloids of the 30s and 40s. And we'll hear the voice of Ouija. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The photographer known as Ouija was often the first photographer at the scene of New York fires, murders, and mayhem. But he was also on the beach and at the opera, capturing the diversity of daily life in New York. His pictures of New York in the 30s and 40s were published in tabloids and magazines. Now he ranks as one of the most eccentric and celebrated news photographers of his time. You can see Ouija's photos and read about his life in the book Ouija's World by my guest Miles Barth. It just won the Best Photographic History Book Award from the American Photographic Society. Barth also curated the recent exhibit of Ouija's work at the International Center of Photography in New York. The show will tour Europe next fall and America in the year 2000. Ouija died in 1968 at the age of 69. In a few minutes, we'll hear a recording of him discussing his work. I asked Miles Barth to describe one of Ouija's most famous photos.
Well, I think his most famous photograph, although it is not necessarily my favorite, it's certainly his most reproduced photograph. And it's an image of two elderly opera patrons entering the Metropolitan Opera on the evening of November 22nd, 1943, for the 50th anniversary of the Metropolitan Opera here in New York. And on the extreme right of the photograph is what we, I guess, would call now a bag woman that Ouija had strategically placed on the edge of the photograph. And the image depicts the two women dressed in furs and jewels coming into the opera with this bag woman looking on from the right. And it was really Ouija's kind of take on the differences in the class struggle that was existing in New York, the difference between the rich and the poor and the well-dressed and the haves and the have-nots. That photograph, Ouija had staged. He had planned the photograph, not necessarily with the two women who were the opera patrons, but he had brought the woman from the Bowery at about 4 p.m. and placed her in the back seat of his car and got her completely drunk and asked his assistant, who relayed this story to me, to stand at the curb and hold the woman up as best as possible. And when the first limousine was to pull up with the first patrons arriving that evening, he was to let go of the woman and Ouija was to make his famous photograph. Unfortunately, none of the daily newspapers published the photograph. He could not find a buyer until Life magazine published it about 2 weeks later. And it was published very small in the lower left-hand corner of a larger article about the 50th anniversary of the Metropolitan Opera. The reason, it turns out, that it was not published by any of the daily newspapers, there were two important reasons. One, it was wartime. And the newspapers were very afraid to show women dressed in jewels and furs while American servicemen were overseas fighting, you know, protecting our country's honor. And the other reason was, it turns out, by chance, that one of the two women in the photograph who walked out of the limousine was a Mrs. George Washington Cavanaugh, who was the major patron of the opera for their 50th anniversary. She was known to everyone in New York at the time, and the newspapers were so frightened that if they were to run this photograph of her, there would be a major reaction from both the opera and from, you know, New York society. So it never really ran in a New York newspaper, but it turns out it's probably Ouija's most famous photograph.
It's a great story. One of Ouija's subjects was dead bodies. I mean, Ouija took photos of corpses with bloodied faces and pools of blood around the body. He has a 1941 picture of a guy in a pool of blood with a dead-on-arrival ticket on his arm. Mm-hmm. There's a picture called Murder on the Roof in which the cops are going through the corpse's pockets. A 1942 photo called Gunman Killed by Off-Duty Cop at Broome Street. And the gunman is lying on his stomach, his face covered with blood, his gun by his side. Now, you know, in relation to these photos, you said the New York Times hardly printed any of his stuff. Ouija wrote, he disagreed with the New York Times editorial policy of not running pictures of local dead gangsters, no matter how prominent. I love that, no matter how prominent. Mm-hmm. Even the famous dead people, they wouldn't print. What were the standards of newspapers at that time in terms of printing blood or printing corpses?
Well, I think it depended on the newspaper, but certainly the New York Daily News and the Post, the Journal American, the Herald Tribune, they weren't afraid of it. It sold newspapers. And Ouija had a very interesting relationship with one newspaper in particular called PM. He was not on staff, and he was never on staff of any newspaper, but PM gave him a $100 a week stipend, and in return for that, they were offered the first photos of Ouija's nightly catch or early morning catch. And whatever they didn't use or whatever they refused, Ouija had the right to go on and sell to other newspapers. And PM was relatively gentle when it came to the crime photos. So Ouija found a much better market at the Daily News and at the New York Post. And the photographs or the style of the newspapers at that time, I believe it was that, you know, it was wartime for the most part, and certainly between 1936 and 1945, Ouija's heyday, the newspapers were not afraid to run that kind of photograph. It sold newspapers. I think by comparison, today's newspapers are really quite bland. You rarely see dead bodies in the newspapers, and I think the television has really taken over a lot of that kind of more sensational visual news. But Ouija, besides the photographs of dead bodies, which he did become famous for, he prided himself also on the human interest stories, the people who were watching the crimes, the people who were affected by the crimes and the fires and the tragedies, the auto accidents, whatever it might be. He was always turning around to the crowd. He was not just focused on the event. And what you'll see repeatedly in his photographs, even of the dead corpses on the ground, many times he's just as interested in the crowd that's gathered around. The photo you mentioned of the people on the rooftop, it's certainly, I think, the way Ouija has positioned the angle of the photo, the camera, to make that image, he's as concerned with the viewers as he is with the dead body and the police gathered around the body taking fingerprints and doing various police tasks. It's a repeated theme in his work that he was extremely concerned with documenting human emotion.
Ouija prided himself on getting to the scene of the crime and often getting there first. What were his techniques for knowing where the scene of the crime was?
Well, it wasn't a technique. It was a very specific kind of event that took place. In 1938, he was the first photographer ever to be granted a permit from the New York City Police Department to install a radio receiving unit in his car, which was capable of capturing the shortwave broadcasts of the police and fire departments. And it was really, for about 2 or 3 years, he had this edge on the competition. I think Walter Winchell was the first person in New York, first civilian ever to receive that same honor. But Ouija was certainly the first photographer. And as a freelance photographer, and in and of itself, that was quite rare at the time because most of the other newspaper, and most of the other photographers were attached to newspapers or publications or the syndication services. Ouija was completely alone, and he depended on, you know, making a photograph at night that he could sell to a newspaper the next morning, and he did live from night to morning and morning to night. So the ability to be able to arrive at the scene of a crime or an auto accident or a fire or any kind of disaster where one of the city agencies was involved was really to his advantage.
Were there a lot of photographers before him who specialized in being at the crime scene? You know,
well, there were other photographers, certainly, who did crime photographs. I think what made Ouija interesting was his mobility. The fact that he was using a large format but relatively portable camera, something that had a synchronized flash. He had a 1938 Chevy that was equipped. Its trunk was really a portable office. He would type his own captions. He always had about 100 cigars and 100 flashbulbs ready at any one time. He was out there. He was a one-man kind of photo agency, photo syndication service, and he knew all the photo editors of all the New York City daily newspapers and was able to sell photographs to a lot of them. It's been said that in a single week he could make up to $150 to $200, you know, in terms of salary, which was an enormous amount of money at that time.
My guest is Miles Barth, a curator at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan and author of the book Ouija's World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Miles Barth, a curator at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan and author of a book about the photographer known as Ouija. Well, Miles, you've brought something special with you for us to hear, and that is a tape of Ouija talking about his work and how he does it. And this is very interesting to listen to. Tell us about where the tape is from and how you managed to get it.
A number of years ago, in one of the collections we have, I discovered this 33 and a third long-playing record album called Famous Photographers Tell How. And it was a recording of nine different photographers from almost nine different disciplines of photography talking about what made them successful or how you too could be a famous photographer. And Ouija, at the time, 1958, was quite well known in the field of photojournalism and documentary photography, and I think the producers of this record just felt that he was such a character, he would lend an enormous amount of taste and color to the recording. So that's what you're going to be listening to.
Well, let's hear Ouija talking about his work.
I will walk many times with friends down the street, and they'll say, "Hey, Ouija, here's a drunk or two drunks laying on the gutter." I take one quick look at them. I say, they lack character. So even a drunk must be a masterpiece. I will ride around all night or all year looking for a good drunk picture. One of the most beautiful ones I got after riding around 2 years, then I made my drunk picture, was a guy in Amsterdam Avenue. One Sunday morning, about 5 o'clock, he was sleeping underneath a canopy of a funeral undertaking parlor. Now, that to me was a picture. Of course, the obvious title would be Dead Drunk. So, in other words, I am a perfectionist. When I take a picture, if it's a murder or if it's a drunk, it's got to be good. When a person gets in trouble and they get arrested, the first thing they do, they cover up their faces. And editors don't like it. They say, don't give me any excuses. Give me a picture so our readers can see what the person looks like. For example, a woman, the New York cops arrested a woman who was wanted for a $25,000 jewel robbery in Washington, D.C. The woman, being a dope, was naturally captured. She was in a cell downstairs in the basement of Manhattan Police Headquarters. I went down, she started to cover up. I says, look, lady, save your energy. I'm not going to take your picture. All I want to do is talk with you. She says, now, I know what you want. You want to take my picture. Why should I let you? So my friends, relatives, and mother can see it on the front pages of the newspapers. I said, now, wait a minute, lady. Don't be so hasty. You have your choice. Do you want your picture to appear in the papers, a Rose Gallery picture with your number underneath it? Or would you let me make a nice home portrait study of you using nice, soft lighting like Rampant would have done? Talking and arguing with her, I convinced her that was the only logical thing for her to do, to pose for a picture. Now, that was a good catch, you might say, for me, besides the New York cops. Anyway, this showed that by arguing with people, you can get them to uncover. People are reasonable, even jewel thieves.
That's Ouija, recorded in 1958. My guest, Miles Barth, is the author of the book Ouija's World. You can tell from that tape that, you know, Ouija really thought of himself as having a mission.
He was possessed. He was possessed at a certain period of his life. I think, you know, what's interesting for most people to find out about Ouija is that his working career was actually quite short, basically from 1936 to the publication of his book Naked City in 1945. And I think when he's compared to some of his contemporaries, whether it be Robert Capa, who had a almost 35-year career, or Henri Cartier-Bresson, or a number of photographers who would have been his contemporaries, not necessarily people he knew of, but his contemporaries. It's a very, very short period of time that he had a working career. And I think for those 9 or 10 years, he was on the streets almost 7 days a week from 10 at night until 5 in the morning.
Do you think it's fair to say that he had an impact on tabloid photography that came after him?
I think he did. I think he had an impact on it, but it's interesting how technology changed so much during the 1950s that a lot of his photographs and a lot of his technique was really forgotten about when photography switched to the larger format 4x5 cameras, to the more portable 2.25 and then 35 millimeter cameras. I also think, you know, by the late 50s, certainly by the early 60s, that television had replaced so much of the outlet for where photographers could market their photographs that unless they were attached to a syndication or to a magazine or newspaper, there were very few freelance photographers who could make a go of it. I think his influence was really quite extraordinary, but how much that carried over into the sort of next two generations, it's really hard to know.
The most famous tabloid photographers today are the paparazzi, who are often freelancers and often camping out in the bushes waiting for the celebrity to walk out the door, or, you know, hiding behind a building waiting for an embarrassing celebrity moment, or, you know, if they're really lucky, some kind of devastating tragedy that they'll be on the spot to cover. Do you think that Ouija has any connection to that? And was he thought in that was he thought of as a parasite in his time, in the way that a lot of paparazzi are thought of as parasites today?
I'm asked that question a lot because of obviously of recent events where paparazzi have been called into the light of the press and just criticism in general. But you know, Ouija was really making a living doing photographs, not necessarily of celebrities. The work he did of celebrities takes place much later in his life, and I think the work we associate with his important period was not so much about chasing a particular celebrity or a particular event where celebrities might have shown up. If you look in the book and in the exhibition, really a very, very, very small part of it is about people we know of. They were famous at the day for the crimes they might have committed, or they might have been famous for the rescues that they'd performed, but they certainly were not personalities in the same way we would define, you know, radio and showbiz personalities today, or even movie personalities who are being chased constantly. And I'm not sure that Ouija's, you know, relationship to contemporary day paparazzi is really a true one. I'm a bit, in fact, disturbed by when people say that he was the father of paparazzi, because the term paparazzi really comes out of Italy in the 1950s and long after Ouija was finished doing any kind of chasing around after photographs. And the personality photographs that appear in the book and exhibition were really done knowingly by the people who were in the photographs. They were there as photo opportunities, and Ouija was one of many photographers who made those photographs. So I don't like to consider him in the same light as contemporary day paparazzi or, you know, stalkers.
After 1945, he basically left the newspaper world, went out to Los Angeles hoping to make it in movies. Did he have any luck?
He did. He had a little luck. He was in small bit parts in six different films.
So he wanted to act, not be a cinematographer.
Well, I think he wanted to do both. I think he wanted to do anything where he could get inside the kind of Hollywood scene, whether it meant being an actor or being a technical consultant. He did both. Not with a lot of regularity, and I think there were very lean periods in between, you know, when he was working. And it was at that time and during those lean times and idle hours that he started to develop the work that we call distortions, the work he did almost for the last 20 years of his life, where he manipulated images using cameras and lenses and kaleidoscopes and various pieces of glass and plastic to distort straight images. And this is really what grew out of his Hollywood period. In 1952, Ouija came back to New York from Hollywood. He was not really accepted in Hollywood society, and I think he found both the people in Hollywood, as he described them, zombies, and really missed New York. I think he missed the action of just being in the city and came back, but he did not pick up his large format camera ever again. He, in fact, hawked it before he came back to New York. And he started working with small format cameras and medium format cameras, creating and continuing his series of distortions, which he made by either placing plastic or glass in front of the lens of a camera or the lens of an enlarger. He would also attach a kaleidoscope to a camera instead of a lens and photograph right through the kaleidoscope to create very distorted kaleidoscope-looking images. And as he tried to peddle these things to the magazines, they were constantly asking him, well, why not just go back on the streets and do your photojournalism and be the Ouija of old? And he said, well, there is no Ouija of old. This is Ouija the artist speaking, and this is my calling, and this is what I plan to do for the rest of my life, which, in fact, is what he did for the rest of his life.
For my money, I found Ouija the tabloid photographer more of the artist than Ouija the artist.
Well, I think a lot of people do. And I think what happened was in 1945-46, Ouija just got completely overwhelmed, supersaturated to just human misery, basically. He was an extremely sensitive person. Arthur Fellig was sensitive, not Ouija. But Arthur Fellig, I think, had absorbed as many murders and as many kind of victims of fire and crime as he could possibly absorb and record.
Arthur Fellig is the real name of Ouija.
Correct. And I think he just decided when he was in Hollywood and when he came back from Hollywood, back to New York, that he was not going to pick up a camera and document any kind of misery anymore, and that he was going to create this new form of art photography, which I think I was saying the photo editors rarely picked up on. He had much more success with that work in Europe than he did in this country.
My guest is Miles Barth, a curator at the International Center of Photography in New York and author of the book Ouija's World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Miles Barth, a curator at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan and author of a book about the photographer known as Ouija. You know, when Ouija was doing his tabloid photos, it's not like, well, he was photographing the Bowery and then he'd go home to his palace and unwind. He lived in this one-room apartment across the street from police headquarters, and there's actually a photo of it in your show. And, you know, there's like a bed, a desk, a floor, a ceiling, a light bulb. It's really, it's not much of a home.
And you'll notice he's sleeping in his clothes.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
This was a trademark of his. He felt that, I don't know if you're looking at the same photo that I'm thinking of, but in that room, towards the top of the ceiling, he had actually strung a wire across from the police station and hooked it up to a speaker so that when the alarms went off, it was actually going off in his room if he wasn't in his car. So he could literally hop out of bed, just throw his shoes on, and be out the door within a few seconds. So he really resented, you know, sleeping in pajamas. He liked to sleep in his clothes.
Which is probably one of the reasons why some of his colleagues complained about his personal hygiene.
Often and loudly, they complained. And some of the remaining colleagues that can remember how disgusting of a person he was were free to tell me this at their earliest convenience when I was doing the early research on the book and exhibition.
Ouija was a nickname, spelled W-E-E-G-E-E, which is different from the way the Ouija board is spelled. Ouija was a kind of fortune-telling game, spelled differently. People assume that Ouija's nickname came from the Ouija board. Is there any connection, or is there a different source for the nickname?
Well, the source of the nickname is more from the squeegee that he used in the darkrooms of the New York Times when he was drawing prints for the printers. It's just coincidence, maybe, that, you know, when Ouija started to go off on his own and make photographs at night and would bring them back and people would marvel at these, you know, wondrous images and how did you find them and how could you have possibly gotten there before the police or before the fire department, he would say that he was, you know, his powers of fortune-telling were very similar to those of the Ouija board. And I think there's a combination of reasons how he got that name, but it sort of stuck. And as he says in his autobiography, the spelling was purely my own.
How has your impressions of Ouija changed from the time before you started the exhibit to now?
Well, I think maybe they've changed by sensing that underneath the crust, this hardcore, cigar-smoking, brash, filthy, rough, crude, chauvinist pig that Ouija was. There was an Arthur Fellig who was an extremely sensitive, very emotional, someone who was very much shunned by women, who I think for most of his life felt very sad about. I think he always wanted to have a relationship and some kind of normal life, which he never did. And I think there were these two people, and I've discovered the sensitivity of Arthur Fellig and how someone who was so sensitive and shy and almost introverted in some ways could create such an enormous alter ego, Ouija, that lived out the fantasies of what he really wanted to be, but probably couldn't do it without that disguise.
So you think of Ouija as being a disguise for Arthur Fellig?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it was a very ingenious, clever plot to advance himself in a career which he became extremely well known at. He is in almost every history of photography book that has anything to do with photojournalism or documentary photography. And I don't believe that mine is the last generation that will be able to discover him. I think he's going to be continuously rediscovered in the future. And I think other people will come along and do new books of his work, because it really almost stands alone in the period. There are a few photographers that really did as much as he did in such a short period of time, in such a, you know, an incredible city, you know, that existed in New York, you know, between the mid-1930s and 1940s.
Miles Barth, thanks so much for talking with us about the photographs of Ouija.
Thank you.
Miles Barth is the author of the book Ouija's World, which collects Ouija's photos. Barth also curated the exhibit Ouija's World, which originated at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan. It will tour Europe in the fall and America in the year 2000. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Tracy Tannenbaum, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.